Off. Hello, and welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast. We are now at episode 4, the Sugar and Currency Acts. Last week we spoke about the Proclamation of 1763 and its adverse effect on the western frontier of the American colonies. It called for a removal of all colonists that were on the western ridge of the Appalachian Mountains, leaving the conquered territory that we gained from the French during the French and Indian War from the western half of the Appalachian Mountains to the Mississippi River as a pseudo Indian reserve. Now, the Indians saw the writing on the wall and saw that colonial expansion was not going to stop. So Pontiac rebels in the northern territories around the Great Lakes, known as what we know as today as the state of Michigan. Pontiac scores some early victories, conquering a few of the smaller forts, but is stalled out around Fort Pitt and the future city of Detroit. After a few years, he'll eventually cede to the British crown and he will break off his rebellion. It's around the same time that Lord Dunmore's War will break out on the western half of the country around the future state of Kentucky. Shawnee, Delaware Indians will fight it out with some Virginia militiamen as they try and gain a foothold in that western frontier territory. Now, the story for the Indians will pick up as the war years progress, but we now have to continue on with the arduous job of going over the Acts of Parliament that will bring us to this future revolution. And not long after the Proclamation of 1763, the British Parliament will implement the Sugar Act. Now, as we talked about when we discussed the Treaty of Paris, under the treaty, British were able to keep the conquered area of Canada that they gained from the French, but they gave up the islands of Guadeloupe and Martinique. Both islands would have been instrumental in relieving some of this war debt because their main export was sugarcane. Sugarcane is used to produce molasses, and molasses is the key ingredient in making rum. So when it boils down to it, if they would have kept those islands, they would have kept their soldiers loaded, and they would have kept the colonists happy. So, on April 5th, 1764, Parliament passes a modified version of the 1733 Molasses Act, which placed a 6 pence per gallon tax on for molasses. Now, the Sugar Act would lower this to 3 pence per gallon. The Act also listed more foreign goods to be taxed, including sugar, certain wines, coffee, pimento, printed calico, and also regulated the export of iron and lumber. Now, you may be asking, what's the big deal with having a lower tax on rum or molasses? Well, it was for foreign imports. So what the British Crown would do is they would import the molasses, sugar, and rum from non-crown-controlled areas and then would turn around and sell it to their colonies at a higher price. Once again, we deal with today a luxury tax on all alcohol that we buy, so what's the big deal? You don't see us revolting about it. Well, the problem was that rum was a staple in pretty much all military and naval jobs. Now, I'm going off of the British Crown standards because I don't know the colonial standards. I haven't been able to find a source that gives me what their rum rationing was, but I could pretty much guarantee it was very similar to the British military, considering that most soldiers that fought for the Continental Army fought in the French and Indian War with the British military, at least the officers fought. So when we look at rum rationing, you don't get a shot a day or two shots a day. It would be diluted with water. Rum back then was a much stronger product than what we get off the shelf today. I mean, everyone loves a little Captain in them, but this stuff was some pretty hefty stuff. So what they would do is they would dilute it with water. So you would get a quart of water and mix in 1 pint of rum, which you would then distribute a cup twice daily to the soldiers, and that was their ration of rum for the day. It was better known as grog. Now, you could see yourself getting a boost in your rationing if you did something good. You could see yourself with an extra quarter or half ration because you did something great. You know, you noticed that there was extra poop on the poop deck. So what you would do is you clean that up, tell the captain, "Well, sir, this, you know, this needed attention and no one was assigned to do it, so I took it upon myself to clean the poop deck." And the captain would say, "Hey, that's great. I was tired of walking on the poop deck when it was all dirty." So he would say, "You get yourself an extra half ration for the day." Now, granted, rum giveth and rum taketh away. If you did something wrong, you would see you losing rum rationing. For example, if you were sleeping at your post, well, that's a big no-no. And with the subsequent flogging that would probably come with it, you would also lose rum rationing for a decent amount of time. People always say, "Rum, what's the big deal? Why did this do sailors need it? Why did the soldiers need it?" We got to remember, shipboard men, you're on a tiny vessel looking at the same ugly mugs for weeks and months on end. Now you ask yourself, could I look at the same, you know, 27 dudes, 47 dudes, 60 dudes at any given point? Because I couldn't. And trust me, they only get uglier and smellier as the weeks and months go on. So the rum was a outlet for sailors aboard ship. So you can only imagine the horror on the colonists' face as they were told that the key ingredient to one of the sailors' most beloved pastimes is now being taxed, and not even in their favor. There's a lower tax for the British Crown to import it from foreign places, but they hike up the price for the export. Another huge problem was, as I said earlier, they regulated the export of lumber and iron. The sugar colonies, the French West Indies, for example, in the Caribbean, needed the lumber and the iron to build an infrastructure for plantations of sugarcane. So when you limit the exportation of lumber and iron, now they're floundering. So the limited exports of lumber and iron from the American colonies has cut their income, which now has in turn limited their ability to import and pay for British merchandise. So the boycotting ensues in the American colonies. From the boycotts, British merchants are losing money. The British merchants will then go to the Parliament and say, "Hey, we need to do something about this Sugar Act. It's losing us tons and tons of money in the Americas." And Parliament decides in 1766 to repeal the Sugar Act. Now, just a point to make about the boycotting of the Sugar Act. Well, that was started by some gentlemen who would band together and boycott the illegal taxation of the British Parliament. We best know these gentlemen as the Sons of Liberty. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is that the American colonies aren't boycotting the Acts of Parliament just for the sake of boycotting. The continued taxation and import and export regulations that the British Parliament put on the American colonies is going to be a drain on the economy inside the colonies. The problem is, the American colonies, at least till now, have no gold or silver mines to speak of. So their only way to obtain currency is through trade. But, of course, that's going to be regulated through the British. So the colonies will have to take it upon themselves to develop their own currency system for combating this problem. So with a lack of hard currency, what they do is develop an interesting system of paper money that could be used to pay off bills of credit. These bills were issued by land banks and loan offices. The problem was that this paper money system was extremely complex. Some were used to pay for interest only, some purchases. Others pay for public debt, but these could not pay for private transactions. Seriously, what the heck does any of that mean? If we can't figure it out and we're in the modern age, then how the heck were the colonials supposed to understand this system? So there's little surprise that on September 1st, 1764, Parliament passes the Currency Act. It's meant to abolish this system completely. Of course, the colonials speak out. Now, personally, I feel little outcry for a system whose paper money was about as useful as the stuff that you wipe with. But to the colonials who were lacking a hard currency, this was a real affront to them because they're trying to become a self-sufficient system. If the British Crown won't give them hard currency, they can't dig up gold and silver themselves, they have problems with importation and exportation, and when they do develop a somewhat useful system of paper currency for the exchange of debt and paying off private transactions and so on and so forth, then why the heck does the British Crown really care if they're trying to become self-sufficient? Oh, wait, now I get it. Of course Britain doesn't want them to become self-sufficient, because that would mean they're self-sufficient. And what other type of government would really want its colonists becoming self-sufficient? That means that they don't rely on you anymore. Oh, now I get it. Well, for the colonists, they don't get it. And they feel that the British Crown is only trying to keep them down. But as hard as they try, they cannot keep the Currency Act from happening until it's repealed. Because it was a act that banned the use of paper of the paper money system, but Parliament has to rescind it because they are still in serious debt. And by the time the 1770s hit, those debt issues forced Parliament to really reevaluate the paper money system. And so they'll issue paper money of their own that will be used to pay some of this war debt that they've accumulated over the years. So in the end, the Currency Act, though a good attempt at a paper monetary system, really, really fell by the wayside. And though the Sons of Liberty probably harped in on it pretty hard early on, I don't think a lot of colonists were really crying about the loss of a paper money system that, well, in so many words, made zero sense whatsoever. So that should do it for this week. Next week, I plan on continuing our discussion on the Acts of Parliament with the Stamp Act and the Quartering Act, both of which are going to really start to light the fire under the Sons of Liberty as they become more and more belligerent in the city of Boston and will really want to take the fight to the Redcoat Station there. Now, for this week's recommendation, I have decided against doing a book because, well, there isn't a lot of reading material on the Sugar Act and the Currency Act, so I thought I would go with something a little more fun. And one of the first media recommendations that I'm going to do is actually a classic Disney film called Johnny Tremaine. It is a wonderful family movie. It takes some liberties with the American Revolution at some points. It's not the most historically accurate, but seriously, what Disney movie is? It chronicles the story of a young man named Johnny Tremaine as a young silversmith's apprentice in the city of Boston. He falls in with the Sons of Liberty. It chronicles his time with the Sons of Liberty leading up to the fight at Lexington and Concord. It truly is a wonderful movie for people with families or if you just love watching Disney movies, because I know I do. So that'll do it for this week. So from the American Revolution podcast, everyone have a great week and always remember to keep your powder dry.